First of all, I wanted to thank you very much for the invitation to give a talk to such a distinguished audience and also for the introduction. And I wanted to thank you all for being here on a Sunday afternoon. The title of my talk is How Does Nature Compute? So I'm going to try to spend the next minutes trying to convince you that actually computation happens around us all the time, that nature actually does computation. But before doing that, I'm going to spend several moments trying to dissociate in our minds the thought, the notion of computation from the notion of electronic computers, because nowadays they seem to have become synonymous, which should not necessarily be the case. So before going to how nature computes, let me talk about computers for a bit. Computers, we all know that they do marvelous things. They can help fly spaceships to Mars. This in case one knows how to convert from inches to centimeters. They can control aircraft. They can be used in robot-aided manufacturing for entertainment purposes, for computer games, if you are in academia, to expedite journal submissions. And I think everybody uses them to do email. Now, the question is, they do all these marvelous things. But what is it actually that computers do? So it turns out that if you look at what computers are and what they do, they are fairly simple. Basically, a computer is a collection of switches, you know, like a normal switch that does that can be in on position, electricity on, and in off position, electricity off. These are interpreted as bits 0 and 1. And the whole computer is a collection of some such switches where the data is simply long strings of 0 and 1 and nothing more. So how about operations? What operations can computers perform? It turns out that at the bottom level, actually computers can do only very, very simple things. What can you do? You can flip a bit value. So you can flip a bit from 0 to 1 and vice versa. That is corresponding to turning the switch on and off. You can zero a bit, that is if the bit is 0 or 1, whatever it is, you change it to 0. And you can test the bit. Namely, you ask, if the bit is 0, you do something. If the bit is 1, you do something else. So basically, this is all that a computer is capable of doing. Then the question arises, if a computer is so simple, if it's only a collection of switches, and all you can do is this very, very simple task, how do you accomplish all these complex things? How is it possible to do it? In order to explain that, I wanted to use an analogy for the way a computer works to the baking a cake. Well, I don't know for you, but for example, to me, a chocolate cake is a very complex thing. So, however, if you think about how a chocolate cake is baked, you start from the ingredients. So you have the eggs, the flour, the milk, the chocolate, and so on. On top of that, there are only very limited things that you can do. You have some utensils, for example, the oven, the mixer, the spoon, the fork, and so on, some pots and pans. And actually, the actual operations that you can do with this are very simple. What do you do, actually? You can change the temperature in the oven. You mix some ingredients, you can put some ingredients together. So the basic operations are very simple. So how do you get such a very complex task, such as obtaining a chocolate cake? How do you get it, given that the ingredients are so simple and actually the operations are so simple? And the answer is that the magic is not in how complex the utensils are or how complex the hardware is. The magic is in the recipe. The magic is in the thought, the recipe that tells you, do this and this for such a time and combine this and this and after this do that. So the magic is in the recipe, in the thought process, and not in the hardware. It's the same with explaining how come the computers do such wondrous things. Here, the inputs or the ingredients are bit strings. They are long strings of 0 and 1 one after another. The things that you can do, you know, as I mentioned, they are very simple. You have these bits and you can flip them from 0 to 1 and vice versa. You can zero a bit and you can test a bit. That's all. So the way you can get the output, so complex and wonderful output, is in the recipe, or if I were to use a computer science terminology, it's in the algorithm, in the computer program that does it. So the magic is in the thought that is behind it, it's not in the hardware. And actually, the fact that we are using now electronic means of computation and not something else is more of a historical fact. And in fact, the theoretical notion of computation or of algorithm preceded the invention of electronic computers. So actually, the formal model of what computation is the Turing machine, which was invented in 1936 by Turing, and consists of the following very simple things. So now I'm talking about the abstract model of computation, which I'm trying to dissociate from the implementation of an electronic computer. So what does this Turing machine consist of? We have the data, which actually are strings of symbols written on a tape, and the operations that a Turing machine, which is a formal model of computation, can do are fairly simple. You have a head that moves along that tape, and that head can do the following thing: read whatever is written on square in the tape, can overwrite the symbol with another, and can move left or right. So a Turing machine looks sort of like this. You have a tape. This one is a semi-infinite tape that has some strings written on it, and you have this read-write head that moves left or right and rewrites or not something on the tape. This is the abstract model. Based on this, a computation, by definition, is a finite list of instructions of the following type. If you are in some state and you read an input symbol, then write something and move left or right. So this is basically, if you try to think of your common laptop or your desktop computer, this is what it does. It's a list of instructions that tells you that if I have a blue screen with three windows on it, and if I press Ctrl-Alt-Del, then the computer is going to shut down or whatever starts. So this is all there is to it. You have the state, the various states that the computer can be in, and you have a finite list of instructions. As you notice, there are two things to point out about this abstract model of computation and the definition of computation that is Turing machine. First of all, these Turing machines that in principle, they look so simple and primitive. Actually, they are capable of universal computation in the sense that everything that can be is defined by human beings to be computable can be computed by this Turing machine. And secondly, the point that I wanted to make is that the abstract notion of computation, well, you can call it Turing machine, or you can call it algorithm, or you can call it a program, it's hardware independent. I have never mentioned once the fact that you have to have bits 0 and 1, the fact that you have, you know, to 0 a bit, test a bit, the fact that you have an electronic computer. This is like a thought experiment. This is an abstract notion of computation, which is hardware independent. So proof that this is notion of computation is hardware independent is the history of hardware that was used for computation. The very first attempt to automate the computing process was the invention of Abacus somewhere in China some 2,000 years ago, which actually is still used in some countries to compute the change if you go to the grocery store. So it's a very robust method of computing. Now, for a long time, nothing happened until in 1642, Pascal invented the mechanical adding machine, which is based on a system of gears, like one of them has 10 times more teeth than the other. So, you know, in order to do addition and to switch from tens to hundreds to thousands, you make use of the fact that a revolution of one wheel, you know, one wheel has 10 times more teeth than the other. So based on that, you can do changes of order of magnitude. Then in 1801, Jacquard invented the punch card loom, so which was the first thought of using punch cards in order to automate some process. In 1833, Babbage thought of, but actually never actually implemented, a difference engine which did certain mathematical operations automatically. In 1890, Hollerith invented the punch card system, which was the precursor of actually the first electronic computer, the ENIAC, Electronic Numerical Integrator and Calculator, which was built between 1939 and 1945. Well, this is the actual picture. Look at this thing. So it was on the total surface is 167 square meters. It had 18,000 vacuum tubes and it was not programmable. I have seen a piece of this at the museum in Philadelphia. Actually, they are like big plugs weighing like 10 kilos each. And if you wanted to change your program, if you didn't want to do addition anymore, you wanted to do subtraction, you have to actually unplug them and plug them in a different way. It was not programmable. You couldn't run two programs in the same configuration. But this was the beginning. Later on, the invention of transistors and their use led to miniaturization, to the integrated circuits, which are the basis of the electronic computers today. So you see the point that I'm trying to make, rather than making a historical point, is that there are very many possible ways of doing computation. You can do, actually you can build a mechanical computer. In principle, you could build a computer from light switches that can be, you know, on and off. There are many ways in which you can build a computer, and you don't need to do it electronically. So, if I could convince you that I can encode data on DNA strands, if instead of long strings of zeros and ones, my data would be encoded on DNA strands, and if I could convince you that instead of electronic hardware, I could use some enzymes or I could use some biochemical operations on DNA strands that could mimic or simulate arithmetic or logic operations, I should be able to convince you that I can build a DNA-based computer instead of an electronic-based computer. So this is what I'm going to try to do is right now. First of all, how to encode data, how to encode input and output of the computer by using DNA strands. So it turns out that this is a picture of DNA molecule, but this is like a too complex picture that has all the atoms and molecules pictured there. Actually, I want us to think of a DNA strand in much simpler terms. You can think of a DNA strand in terms of a necklace. So it's a necklace on which we have only four different kinds of beads. We can have adenine, cytosine, guanine, and thymine. This is the first and last time when I use this term. What is important is that we have four different kinds of beads, A, C, G, T. And the order in which they are placed on this necklace determines what information is encoded there. So the DNA in our bodies or in living beings encodes genetic information. But you can encode also something else. So for example, I can think in abstract terms. If I can encode anything in zeros and ones, surely I can encode everything by using ACGT. So for example, I can think of, you know, a translation of the English alphabet. I decided the letter A is encoding as ACA, the letter B is ACCA, the letter C is ACCA, whatever. You can think of an encoding. And then you can do translation from English text to a string of DNA letters that can be encoded on a DNA strand. So from this point of view, DNA is just an alphabet. So sometimes people ask whether we are going to build a DNA computer, whether it's going to evolve into a, you know, like a molecular Frankenstein or something. It's not like that at all. Like DNA is a very neutral thing. It's just an alphabet. It's just a means. So in the same way as English language can be used to encode, you know, it can be used to write Shakespeare or to write Nazi propaganda, and it's not the fault of the English language or alphabet. In the same way, DNA alphabet is just an alphabet. So I can use it to encode any kind of information. I can use it to encode genetic information that tells me if I'm going to grow as a mouse or I'm going to grow as a frog or a flower. Or I can use it to write numbers, if I so wish. And DNA is completely neutral from that respect. So, you know, if I wish to encode, let's say the number 2004. I decide what is my encoding, like 2 is going to be ATGAA, 0 is going to be whatever strand, and then I just can call the lab. Okay, every university has a lab like this, a synthesis of DNA. And next day I'm going to get a small test tube, you know, as small as this, on the very bottom of which is going to be a very small droplet of clear fluid in which we are going to swim billions of strands, DNA strands, that encode exactly that number. I can encode anything, therefore I can encode also numbers. So this I can encode any kind of information as a DNA strand because of this DNA synthesizer. Now, before I go on to bio-operations that you can do on this DNA strand, I wanted to make one more point. So I mentioned that DNA strand can be viewed as a necklace with combinations of four different beads on it. So it turns out that DNA strand can exist in two states. You can have either a single DNA strand, which is like a necklace, but these letters, these beads, are complementary. They attract each other. A attracts T and C attracts G. And if two DNA strands that are completely complementary, if they meet each other, they are going to stick to each other and then form the double helix that we are all accustomed to. So there are two things. You can have single strands which have a tendency to be sticky, in the sense that if you find a complementary strand, it's going to stick to it. And you can have double strands, which are, you know, that picture is a double DNA strand. All right, so I hope I made the case that you can encode any kind of information, including numerical information or anything else, as a DNA strand. Now, what about operations? What can I do with this DNA strand? Well, it turns out that there are plenty of things that you can do. Like a molecular biology lab is like a treasure chest. There are many tools that you can use to manipulate DNA strands. For example, there are some dynamic entities called enzymes that can look at a DNA strand, recognize a very specific sequence, let's say ACCA, and cut a DNA strand exactly at that location. So you can have like site-specific cut of DNA strands. You can also have spacing of DNA strands, like the opposite operation. You can also use an enzyme to make as many copies of a DNA strand as you want, and so on. You can do lots of things with that. So it turns out, for example, and we had some theoretical work on this a couple of years ago, it turns out, for example, that a combination of these cut and paste operations, bio-operations I'm going to call them because they are completely biological, can be used to simulate any operation of a Turing machine. You remember what a Turing machine did? Anything you can compute, you can do with a Turing machine. So it turns out that the combination of these cut and paste operations can simulate any operation of a Turing machine, which means that in principle, a DNA computer can do anything that an electronic computer can do. Now, if this strikes you as unintuitive, if it strikes you as very unlikely, the fact that you can do addition and subtraction and so on by cutting and pasting DNA strands, please remember that it is as unintuitive the fact that you can do anything on your laptop by that Turing machine, you know, that moves left to right and rewrites one square at a time. It is as unlikely. However, it can be done. So anything that an electronic computer can do, actually a DNA computer could also do. And the first experimental demonstration of this was in 1994 when Leonard Edelman at the University of Southern California solved the Hamiltonian path problem, or the traveling salesman problem, which is a hard computational problem, by sole use of DNA strands in test tubes. So actually his problem was performed in 1/50th of a teaspoon of solution, and it lasted for 7 days. The finding the solution to this problem lasted 7 days. But, you know, it was a proof of principle. It was the first time ever that it was proved that this thing can be done, that you can find a solution to your mathematical problem by pouring in a test tube some DNA strands, by shaking it well, adding something, you know, and then out come the answer to a mathematical problem. This is very unintuitive. So this was created quite a stir in scientific circles because it was the first time that it was shown that this can be done. Since then, many other experiments have been done. For example, at the University of Western Ontario, my student Mark Daly and I did some implementation of computation of insertions and deletions of DNA strands, and there are many others. Now, the latest experimental results that was impressive was also in the lab of Len Edelman in 2002, where it was the first time when they solved the 20-variable satisfiability problem, which is also a very famous computer science problem. The important thing about this was the following. Now, the first problem was a very small instance, which, you know, you could easily solve with a pen and paper. It was just a proof of principle to show that it can be done. But this solving the 20 variable satisfiability, it was the first time when it was shown that DNA computing can solve problems that go beyond the unaided human intellectual power. Not beyond yet, not beyond what an electronic computer can do, but beyond what a human can do with a pen and paper. So this is why this is also a landmark. Well, so if this can be done, you are going to ask me next, am I going to produce from behind the desk here, am I going to produce a DNA-based laptop and let you see it? Well, the short answer is no. And the short answer is no for various reasons, mainly based on the fact that all these experiments that happen in the molecular biology lab, they are not 100% reliable in the same way as the electronic computer is. So, you know, I told you that enzymes can cut and paste. Well, they cut and paste and they're in the right place 99% of the time, not 100%. And all these things, you know, if you want two molecules that are in very far away, if you want them to interact, you have to be sure that eventually they're going to meet each other. So there are some reasons why we do not have yet a DNA-based computer. But one answer to that is the following. So you see, one of the problems is like error detection and error correction. But one answer is the following. These technical difficulties that are encountered in experimental DNA computations, such as error detection or error correction, they are all routinely solved by biological systems in nature. Like cells do this all the time. They have all the time this problem, how to make two molecules that are far away to interact, and how to deal with correct errors and how to correct them. This happens all the time. So idea is was to study and utilize the computational abilities of unicellular organisms and see what you can learn from them and try to use them. So one of the way of doing that is the studying of the computational abilities of ciliates. It's a project that I'm working with my colleague Laura Landweber from Princeton University, who is a molecular biologist. So she's studying ciliates, which are this unicellular protozoan, which move around by using this wisp-like covers of cilia. And so they are one-cell organisms, okay? This is not a one-to-one. They are very small, minuscule one-cell organisms. And she's studying them in her lab for the following purposes. So it seems that ciliates have a very interesting So when two civets meet each other, you can have like a sexual genetic exchange without reproduction. So you don't have, in this case, a third civet. It's just the genetic information exchange. What happens is the following. So let me backtrack a little bit. There are many different types of ciliates, but all of them have two types of nuclei. One of them is called the macronucleus, it's the bigger one, and it contains all the genes that regulate the everyday functioning of the ciliate. You know, the bread and butter that tells it how to move, how to get food, and so on. That tells the organs how to function. The other one is called the micronucleus, and it actually contains some sort of encrypted version of the macronucleus, and it doesn't play any role except in this genetic information exchange. So what happens when two ciliates meet? You know, like you have a mitosis, meiosis, and here you have like a exchange of genetic information. It's like I'm exchanging whatever. I'm exchanging my information about my blonde hair with your information about your long legs, and you know, we have a, both of us are going to be better ciliates at the end. Anyway, so after that, each ciliate, they do separate, and each of them has their own new micronucleus, and in a period that varies between 12 and 48 hours, they have to develop to decrypt the information in the micronucleus and develop the macronucleus without which they would die, because the macronucleus contains the information that tells how they are going to develop. So the process that I'm going to focus on now is how do the ciliates decrypt the genetic information from the micronucleus to the macronucleus. Let me focus a little bit on that. So I assume that this is, for example, a functional copy of a gene. A gene is just a long DNA strand. So it's a long strand of ACC, GG, ACC, AAA, and so on. So this is a copy of a gene in the macronucleus, a functional copy, final copy, and this is the encrypted copy in the micronucleus. So just for pictorial purposes, I assume that this gene is, you know, divided into segments, 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7. Now please notice that these segments in dark blue are present also in the encrypted version, but they are interspersed with very long, you know, useless segments of DNA. And moreover, what is actually a very peculiar thing and that happens in ciliates, the order is different. So this kind of jumbled order. So the ciliate, when it starts to obtain the macronucleus from the micronuclear information, will have to somehow delete the light blue pieces and rearrange the others in the correct order. How does this happen? So the process by which this happens is the following. Let us assume that we have a long DNA strand. Okay, this is supposed to be contiguous here. So let us assume that we have a long DNA strand. I'm going to denote this UX, WX, Z. These two are both denoted by X to denote the fact that they are identical. If on this long necklace of beads, on this long DNA strand, there are two pieces that are identical, what's going to happen is the following thing. The DNA strand is going to physically coil itself like this, and the portion is going to undergo a strand exchange in X. And as a result of that, the circle is going to be excised. So like you can have a linear DNA strand, but the linear DNA strand can also become circular. You know, if you have some sticky ends, you can imagine it gluing it here, so you can have also circular DNA strands. So the circle between W and X is excised, pops out of the linear DNA strand, while the remaining pieces are glued together. So let me recap. Out of a long DNA strand, if you have two segments that are identical, the segment that is in between can pop out as a circle, and the remaining ones are rejoined. The process can happen also in the other direction. If you have a short linear DNA strand and a circle that share a common piece, then the circle can get inserted in the shorter one, and you can obtain a longer DNA strand. So actually, this is how this is accomplished. I'm just going to go back to this. So how does this insertion and deletion of circles help us descramble the micronuclear DNA into the macronuclear DNA. Well, so it turns out that the following thing happens. So look at here. In the end, piece number one is going to have to be next to piece number two. It just so turns out that piece number one, piece of DNA strand number one, is followed by a very short DNA strand that is identical to a DNA strand that precedes piece number two. So they're so-called pointers. They're something that can work as pointers. You remember what happens if we have two identical pieces? Whatever is in between pops out as a circle, and the remaining pieces are joined together. So here, if we have a pointer after one and the same identical pointer before two, whatever is between one and two pops out as a circle, and one and two suddenly become neighbors in the right portion. So then you have this long circular DNA strand that is inserted in another place, and then, you know, by using a combination of these insertions and deletions of circles, you can obtain the final DNA piece. So what can I say about this? First of all, because this is in a, you know, incorrect order and this is sorted here, you can think of this as a computational problem. This is a very well-known computational problem, sorting. If you have something in the wrong order, how do you get it in a right order? So I can think of this already as a computation. But it's more than that. You can think of a formal system in which the only operations you can do are insertions and deletions of circles. And you can ask how powerful this formal system is. This is like the same question as if I were asked the following thing. Let's assume that I can do only additions and subtractions. How powerful can I be as a system? It's a similar kind of question, only that here I have this slightly peculiar operation where I had insertions and deletions of circles. So we have defined a so-called guided recombination system, which is a formal computational system based on insertions and deletions, circular insertions and deletions. And actually, we have proved in 1999 that such systems have the same computational power as Turing machines. So actually, this says the same thing that I was saying before about DNA computing in general. This says that these operations of insertions and deletions of circles that happen in this unicellular protozoan have potentially the same computational power as any electronic computer. Well, this means that what they are doing are potentially computations, and moreover, perhaps it is possible to so-called build a programmable cell that instead of solving its own problem, can solve the problem that we give it to solve. So this points out the potential computational power of unicellular protozoan. I wanted to point out one more thing about the essential feature of biocomputing, whether it is in the lab or whether it is in the computational processes that happen in unicellular protozoan or in other cells. An essential feature of this biocomputing is the self-assembly. You see, these are DNA strands, and everything happens, so to speak, by itself, just by the virtue of the chemical interactions between molecules or between molecules and enzymes. Now, nobody takes with one hand the DNA strand, with the other hand the DNA strand, and puts them together. You know, they're too small to do so. But, you know, things happen by themselves. DNA molecules self-assemble in order to form other DNA molecules. So this is actually, it's an essential feature of biocomputing, the fact that everything happens by self-assembly. So then the idea in other areas of research in DNA computing is to use knowledge, the knowledge of how these molecules interact, how do DNA molecules and enzymes interact, and actually design a setup such that the computation happens essentially by itself. This has become even more important because of the advance of nanotechnology, where the components are too small for existing tools. Now, this whole field of nanotechnology is dealing with things that are so small that you cannot use tools to assemble them. You know, it's like if I would try to brush my teeth with a broom. The broom is too big. You cannot do it. Or if you try to build a on a car that is much smaller than the smallest tip of your screwdriver, you cannot use the existing tools in order to manipulate it. So then the way to go around this is to design the components in such a way so that they self-assemble, you know, that the wheel is going to go by itself where it's supposed to go, and the steering wheel and the seat and so on, so that the car, so to speak, builds by itself. Well, there are many fields in which self-assembly is useful. So actually, I'm not going to work for now with a field in particular. I'm going to talk about a model of self-assembly. So how do we study this self-assembly? How do we model it? Well, the mathematical model of self-assembly, the basic unit is called a tile. I don't want to go more concrete than that, because a tile can signify anything. You know, for example, two molecules of hydrogen and one molecule of oxygen, they self-assemble to form a molecule of water. But, you know, there are so many instances that we have to abstract a little bit the concept and see how it works in order to apply it. So in this abstract modeling of a self-assembly, one component is going to be a tile, which is a square where each side is painted with a certain kind of glue. In this particular model, tiles cannot be rotated, and two adjacent tiles will stick to each other only if they have matching glues at the touching edges. Now, a tile system will consist of a finite number of tiles, and we have a limited supply of each tile type available. So let me give you some examples of this tiling system and some tiling problems. So one of the classic tiling problems, which was asked long before nanotechnology and DNA computing came into being, is the following. Let us assume that we are given a certain number of tiles of different types. The question is, can any square of any size be tiled by using only the available tile types and without violating the glue matching rule? So let us think of this in more concrete terms. Let us assume that you want to tile a bathroom, and you have a certain number of tiles, and you know, you can put them only so that the colors match because you want a nice pattern. The question is, can you tile any size of bathroom with it or no, with a given tile set? So let me show you an example where the answer is yes. Let us assume that these are my tile types. Well, I just use for graphical purposes, I use this representation where this represents that this represents the fact that the north tile is painted red and all the other sides of the tile are painted white. This representation says that the west tile is painted red, the west edge is painted red, the south edge is painted black, and the other two are white. Are you okay with this? So I have three tile types. Can I tile a square of any size? In this particular case, it turns out that the answer is yes. So just look at this. Let us assume that we start with this one that has black on top. The one that has black on top has red on the bottom. So if it has red on the bottom, if we want not to violate the tile matching rule, the only tile that we can put is this one that has red on top. So I have to put this one. I cannot put another one. What can I put under it? This one has white on the bottom. So the only one that has white on the top is going to be this one. So I'm going to have to put this one. So as you notice, I can go doing this ad infinitum. I can repeat these three tiles one after another, and I'm okay vertically. Now what can I do horizontally? Let's assume that I want to do the second column. This one has red on the right side, so the only one that has red on the left side is this one, the second tile. So I have to put this one. After which, all I do is repeat the other three again. So it's like a translation by one. I just shift by one down, and I can do the same thing, and so on. So you have this nice pattern, and it turns out, because you can go, you know, as low as you want and as much rightwards as you want, that you can tile any size of a square by using this. However, look at this one. You know, these tiles look very similar. There are three tiles. The first one is identical. this one, you know, it has reds to the left and reds to the bottom, but you know, they look fairly similar. Let's see if here we can tile any size of square. Let's see in particular if we can tile a square of size 3x3. So if we start with this one, the only thing that you can put to the south of it is this one, because this one has white on the top. This one has red on the bottom, so the only thing that we can put is this one again. Yes, this is the only choice. What can you put here on the right? On the right-hand side, we have white. So there is another variant, putting this one on the top, but that's going to fail too. So let us assume that we put this one to the right. This one has black to the north, on the top, and black on the bottom. So the only thing you can do is put a repetition of these tiles one after another. Okay, what can you put on here? This one has red on the right, so we can only put this one. So let us assume that we are in this spot here, which is blank so far. The only thing that we can put here is the following. If we want not to violate the color matching rule here, we should put something that has red on the top. But this is the only one that has red on the top, and this would not fit on the left, because this one has white on the left, this one has red on the left. So I cannot put that one. The only thing that I can put in order not to violate the color matching rule here is this tile, but this one will violate the color matching rule on the north. So I cannot put that one either. So it turns out that even for this very small 3x3 squares, there is no way whatsoever in which I can arrange the tiles without violating the color matching rule. So even for this very small size of tile set, like three tile set, sometimes I can tile any size of square, sometimes not. And it turns out that it is undecidable. We cannot tell for a given set of tiles if you can do this or the other. So if you look at this self-assembly in the context of really trying to build something out of it, if you want to build a nano car out of a set of tiles of components, there are very many very interesting questions that arise. For example, what is the minimal number of tile types that can self-assemble into a given shape, say a car, you know, or a square, if you want to start modestly, so that can self-assemble into a given shape, but nothing else. You know, if you build something, you want to build only that thing, not three other things in parallel. You want them to uniquely assemble in a shape. So what is the minimal number of tile types that can self-assemble into a given shape? Or if you think in terms of chemistry, and if your tiles are actually modeling molecules, what is the optimal initial concentration of tile types or of molecules that ensures the fastest self-assembly? Now, there are lots of practical questions to be asked. Or if you still think in terms of molecules and the fact that we have chemical bonds, what happens if the bonds have different strengths? Until now we had something very simplistic, you know, red matches red, white matches white. What happens if the connection between red and red is stronger than the connection between white and white? What can you say then? So the problem that we have been working on is the so-called ribbon problem, which I'm going to show an example of a ribbon shortly. And the problem is the following. Given a tile system, that is, you know, I come up to you with a set of tiles, can we determine whether or not it can produce shapes that grow indefinitely? So actually, this is a problem that has quite strong practical implications, because this says the following. You know, if I have a set of tiles that can form a car, I have designed them so that they can self-assemble in a car. If besides the car, these tiles can also self-assemble in a structure that has sort of cancerous growth, that can grow unlimited, you know, to unlimited size. And if by mistake, instead of starting doing the car, it starts the other structure first, the other structure is just going to eat up all your tiles. You'll have nothing left for the car. So it is quite an important question, in other words, whether a given set of tiles can produce structures that grow indefinitely or not. It turns out that this problem is completely equivalent mathematically to the following problem: whether we can say whether or not a set of given tiles can produce unlimitedly long ribbons. So let me show you an example of unlimited ribbon. This is the set of styles. This one that have black, black, white, 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 red, red, and these are the other styles. So how do I prove here, for example, that this set of six styles can produce arbitrarily long ribbons? Well, just look at this for a minute. Like this style can produce arbitrarily long horizontal ribbons. You know, it can glue them onto one another, it can make this arbitrarily long. This one can produce arbitrarily long vertical ribbons. And these four can be used to turn corners. So, you know, I can build this, but I can go and build an infinitely long ribbon. So some tiles can do that, some others cannot. So what is the answer to this problem? Well, the answer is, I'm afraid it was like a 10-year-old open problem, and the answer is in the negative. So the answer is the following. There is no algorithm, and I want to make it much stronger. There is no algorithm, no computer program, and there never will be for solving the ribbon problem. So what do I mean by this? I mean that I can never, and nobody can ever, write a program that has as input the following thing, that has as input a given set of styles, and output is, yes, I can build an infinite ribbon with them, or, no, I cannot build one. Such an algorithm does not exist. And it's not because the computers are not strong enough or because you are not smart enough. You can actually mathematically prove that you cannot write such an algorithm. It is true that this doesn't mean that in some particular cases, you know, for that particular set of styles, the sixth one, I could tell immediately that I can draw an infinitely long ribbon. But what I'm saying is that I cannot have a program that gives me the answer in every instance, you know. For some particular instances, I can say, but there is no such program that for every set of styles that I give tells me yes or no. So, as I said, you can devise the program that might work quite well on some of the inputs, but there always will be some particular set of styles for which the algorithm will misbehave, which means either it will run forever or produce the wrong output. So actually this points out to a very interesting problem in computer science, and very subtle and very fascinating, is the barrier or the border between the computable and uncomputable. An algorithmic problem that admits no solution, which means for which there is no algorithm or program ever that can solve it, it's called uncomputable. Or, if it is a yes-no problem, like in our case, yes, we can have an infinite ribbon, no, you cannot have an infinite ribbon, such a problem is termed undecidable. So our result basically is that the ribbon problem is undecidable. You can never ever write, you know, even if your resources are the whole universe and you have the smartest people ever, you cannot write an algorithm to solve it. So sometimes you cannot do it. There is a barrier between problems which do have solutions and some other problems for which you can provably show that there is no solution and there never will be. Now, does this stop people from working on self-assembly? No, fortunately. As I mentioned before, this is a result about the general problem of self-assembly, that, you know, you throw any tile system at it, outcome is the answer. You cannot do that. We proved you cannot do that. But it turns out that for a particular set of tiles, you can do computation very well, thank you. So actually, there has been quite a bit of experimental work in self-assembly. For example, Paul Rodemont, who was also working with Lena Edelman at Southern California, did actually an implementation of self-assembly using capillary forces and using plastic tiles. So actually he used like really plastic tiles that were on a surface with water, and they would self-assemble because of the capillary forces between them. What he intended to do is to assemble to self-assemble a sort of a fractal picture, which is like this Sierpinski triangle. So he had some tiles that, for example, you know, they are glued with yellow, yellow on top, yellow, yellow on the left, yellow, blue on the bottom, and so on. And he had many copies of each of these tiles available and tried to see if they were self-assembled into a Sierpinski triangle. So actually the results of this So this was the abstract implementation. These are actually the real tiles that she used. So these are like small plastic tiles on a surface with a little water on them. And the Sierpinski triangle, the result that was supposed to come out was this one, and actually this is the result that came. Well, so this might look to you not very much like this, but considering that the method is so brute, you know, like they have to, these plastic things can come together only because of capillary forces. I think that the result was pretty good. But I can show you a much better result. So it turns out that, and the reason why I'm talking about this, it turns out that you can do DNA computing by self-assembly. So actually this is the work done by Eric Winfrey at Caltech University and Ned Seaman at New York University. So Ned Seaman, he works with DNA and he does amazing things with DNA. So he can do just about anything with DNA. So this is a cube made out of DNA strands, and he made Boromir rings and all kind of interesting topological structure like this. Well, this is non-trivial, given that the DNA is so small, you cannot really put your hand or anything on it. You just have to make it, do it by itself, glue to each other by itself to form this, by designing it so that it will interact with one another in such a way. So he's a wizard. He can do anything out of DNA. Well, it turns out that they used this DNA in order to form some tiles that will actually perform a computation. So instead of drawing a Sierpinski triangle, they will draw a computation. Let me try to explain a little bit what these tiles look like. So do you remember that I told you that DNA can exist as either single-strand or double-strand? So we can design them in such a way. You can have a tile like this, which is double-stranded most of the parts, but here in the corners, you know, you have something that looks sort of like this. So it's double-stranded on most of the parts. It is double-stranded, it doesn't interact with anything. But it has like a sort of sticky part hanging, which is single-stranded, which means that if it will meet, you know, if there is another tile coming from somewhere else and has exactly complementary DNA sequence, it will stick to it. So you can design DNA tiles that are completely double-stranded internally, but they have four sticky ends that will stick to other tiles that have the matching sticky DNA corners. So you can use them in such a way so that they encode like bits 0 and 1, and they encode them in such a way, I think this was a computation of exclusive OR, that they can do some logical operations. And actually they did some logic operations, you know, where you have the input are two, you know, bits of strings encoded as DNA tiles, and the output is an exclusive OR. Or there is another DNA-based addition that was implemented also by DNA computing by self-assembly. So DNA computing, not only that it can be done, it can be done by this self-assembly process that I tried to describe. Now, well, you know, why should we do it at all? There are many reasons why potentially a biomolecular or DNA computer would be preferable to an electronic computer. First of all is the amazing information density that you can pack on the DNA medium. So it turns out that 1 gram of DNA, which amounts to 1 cubic centimeter when dry, can encode the data which is encoded in 1 trillion CDs. Trillion. Or if you want another comparison, it turns out that 1 pound of DNA would have more information than all the computers ever made by human beings. Or if you want another one, now if you have 5 grams of DNA in a solution, in 1 liter solution like a milk carton, it will contain more information than 150 hectares of the latest IBM disk technology. So it's really, it's like mind-boggling the amazing information density that you encode in DNA. Well, it turns out that if you look at the speed, potentially, DNA-based computer will be 1,000 to 1,000,000 times faster than an electronic computer due to the massive parallels. You have this, all these DNA strands that interact in parallel. And also, it could be thousands of times more energy efficient. So, you know, there are many reasons why people are trying to work this out. Because, first of all, it's so small and you can do things faster and more energy efficient. But it seems to me that the more important thing about DNA computing, rather than, you know, it's smaller and faster and so on, the most fascinating thing is that you can do it at all. You know, like, who would have thought that you can solve mathematical problems by putting DNA strands in a test tube, you shake it well, out comes the result. It is completely not intuitive. So I think that besides having the potential of being a better means of computation, are the philosophical implications of DNA computing that are the most fascinating. So first of all, you know, this discovery sheds new light into the very nature of computation. Maybe this is how nature computes, not by adding and subtracting, but by cutting and pasting DNA strands, or by inserting and deleting circles. Maybe this is how computation is done. This also opens prospects of radically different computers than what we are used to. You know, what will they look like? I don't know. Maybe we'll have to feed them ice cream instead of plugging them into electric power. I don't know. It's certainly different. We have wetware, it's not the hardware anymore, and things happen. The data is not in a fixed point, the data swim in solution, so it's completely different. And what is most important, I think that this points out to a very important philosophical point, and I wanted to cite Len Edelman here. It points out to the fact that biology and computer science are not disciplines, different disciplines. Biology and computer science, or if you want to use different terminology, life and computation are related, are not disjoint. They are related, they have a common basis. Now, what's going to come out of this, I don't know, it's up to us. We have to take this further and see what other insights we obtain, and what we are going to discover, I don't know. But, you know, to quote somebody else, if you knew what it was that we are doing, it wouldn't be called research, would it? Thank you.